Welcome to our session on bread and butter and bread and wine, a scientific and theological look at food. I'm Dave Ellingson, and my partner will be introducing himself in a moment. Before we begin, I'd like to give you a sort of an overview of what we're going to try to get through and accomplish in the next hour or whatever we have left before Vespers begins. We'll begin confessionally. All good Lutheran events begin confessionally, and I think that'll ease some of your feelings. I know all of us feel a little bit uneasy when we start talking about food and nutrition. It brings up all sorts of maybe guilt and maybe some excitement. So we're going to begin confessionally, and I'm looking forward especially to Jim's confessions. You'll hear mine in a moment. We'll talk a little bit about some misconceptions of food, some unlearning, because I think there's as much bad information about food and nutrition around as there is good information. So we'll try and sweep away the debris so that we have some common understandings to begin with. And then I'm going to turn it over to my partner, who will talk from a scientific point of view on what we call bread and butter, the what of eating, and talk about food facts and science and nutrition. And after we've discussed that for a while, I'll be looking at the issue of bread and wine, what might be called the theological aspects of food. We'll be looking at not only the what of food, but the how, the where, the when, the with whom, and the why of food. And then hopefully, if we have some time, we'll get down here to the end and look at some new visions of what nutrition might mean as related to cure, as related to care, as related to change, and then also celebration. So maybe a good way to begin would be to begin with my confession. Recently I published a book. This is an ad for the book. It's in the bookstore. It's called My Body, My Life. One of the chapters in the book was on nutrition. And as I traveled around talking about nutrition in churches, I found that people, when I mentioned the word nutrition or food, I just noticed their bodies, they begin to sort of look down like this. I don't know if they were looking at their stomachs or if they were just embarrassed or what, but I think nutrition sometimes makes us feel guilty because we know we don't eat the way we should, we don't eat the things we should, we don't eat when we should. We probably aren't eating up to our capacity, at least qualitatively, perhaps quantitatively more than we should eat. So I thought, how could I make us all feel one in that? And I have to admit that neither of us are dogmatists about food. I began that chapter with something called Confessions of a Midnight Blind Muncher. Now, if you giggle, you're probably a midnight blind muncher. Let me explain that. Munchers, there are probably a lot of you in the audience. It doesn't make any difference what the food is. You just sort of reach your hand down and grab it, right? Any munchers out there? Few munchers, right? Now, blind munchers, they almost close their eyes. They'll just take anything that comes along. Now, the midnight part is the hardest part. I happen to be a long-distance runner, and I burn up an awful lot of calories running. And I don't eat three regular meals every day. And somehow, about 3 o'clock in the morning, my tank gets a little bit low. So I usually find myself barely awake, wandering around the kitchen, banging into things, blind, reaching in and grabbing and eating things that I would never eat in the day, that in fact I would even preach against during the day. That's the way I live. During the day I'm sort of a Dr. Jekyll, I'm afraid. At night I'm a gastronomic Mr. Hyde, and I suppose all of us probably feel some identification with that. Maybe Jim has some confessions he'd like to share to put you at ease too.
Thanks, Jim. Welcome. I've been teaching and doing research in the area of nutrition for the last 10, 15 years. I guess basically I've been a nutritionist all my life, as I think most of you have. In terms of, confessional kinds of things, I think we all have cravings. And I'm no exception. I have some extreme cravings. And I guess as Dave explained, that creates some guilt, and perhaps a little bit more guilt in me, because I know what I'm eating. I tend to dissect food as I eat it, not necessarily with my teeth, but break it down into its components. And so sometimes it kind of takes away the fun of eating. I did that with the brat and darn near choked on it. I have several weaknesses in terms of food, and one of them, of course, is ice cream. I come from Wisconsin, which is a dairy state, so I can use that as an excuse. Some of the other cravings I have, however, I'm not sure where they originated. But I think as we explore this tonight, maybe that will help take away some of that guilt, because there's a quote I ran across. It's a Chinese quote. It says that food is the first enjoyment of life. And that always struck me. I think it is. Maybe many of us can't remember that, whether it was breast milk or what it might have been, but certainly food is the first enjoyment of life. And I think we should hold that banner high, that food is to be enjoyed. Proper food, however, I think can lead to better enjoyment. And we'll try and explore some of those things tonight. So if you see me madly rushing out after Vespers tonight to hit the ice cream shop, you'll know why. I've kind of been sneaking around here during the day doing that, trying to see when there's not many people around, and been fairly successful in that. A few people have questioned me that know, you know, where I'm coming from. But don't let food kind of get to you. It does to a lot of people. I've talked to a lot of people who develop some very strange guilt complexes about the foods that they're eating. And I think as you help them sort through it, there's one word that I think I would like to pervade this discussion, and that's moderation. If we moderate the things that we eat, I think we'll all be much more successful.
We thought maybe to look at some misconceptions and get rid of some false ideas or some myths about food might be a helpful way to begin. And one which maybe Jim would agree or maybe disagree with me on is that's the whole myth that you should eat 3 square meals a day. Now, that may be the best thing in a particular kind of society where you work a period of time with your hands or with your body, like in an agrarian culture. Most of those notions of a three square meals at maybe 6 o'clock and at noon and 6 p.m. were dependent upon people being out and physically very active. That may work for them, but most of us aren't in those kinds of environments anymore. I happen to be a person who's very active physically, both as a farmer and as a pastor and as a long-distance runner. And I found experientially that I did much better on about 6 moderate to little meals a day. Well, it so happened as I began reading some of the literature on nutrition, at least some of it, not all of it certainly, there are differences of opinion about nutritional habits. But many people felt that that was a better way to go because it's not taxing your stomach, it's not incapacitating you for a period of time after a meal for so long, and it keeps you in that moderate kind of stream that maybe Jim is talking about. So for me, or for people perhaps who have a very active kind of lifestyle, perhaps you might look at the possibility of not just 3 square meals, but a number of moderate meals during the course of the 24 hours. I wouldn't recommend 3 o'clock in the morning, that's dangerous, but maybe 5 or 6 smaller meals. And I think one of the advantages of that, as we'll see later on down the line, is that it allows more chances for celebrating. It allows more chances to be together and to do some of the extra things about nutrition, which aren't just the what's of eating, but some of the with whom's and some of the other things.
Jim? I guess I'm fairly square with you on that. I wouldn't disagree too much. Like, if you tend to spread your meals out throughout the day, a lot of good things happen because of that. One thing I guess I'd caution you against is eating one large meal. And that's common practice among many people in the United States because of oftentimes their lifestyle. Very busy, they skip breakfast, have a very light lunch, if any at all, and then tend to gorge themselves in the evening. They've done this with animals, and animals come down with a number of different diseases as a result of this. And there are a number of medical conditions in which people would benefit if they would eat more often, and not necessarily more, but more often. And just 2 or 3 times a day. Some of the other misconceptions that I guess I'd like to look at is, are we the best fed nation in the world? Probably not. We probably have the best food available to us. We suffer from a form of malnutrition, which most of the other world doesn't suffer from, and that's overnutrition. Part of our problem, I think, lies in the fact that we have too many choices. If you go into a grocery store, I've never counted them up, but people have, nearly 5,000 different choices in a large supermarket. That's a lot of different choices to make as one goes up and down the aisle. What can happen as a result of that is that people, instead of trying to make those choices on a weekly or a daily basis, however often they go to the supermarket, they tend to eat just a few foods. So they get in ruts. And that is a dangerous thing too, eating the same foods all the time. We all have our favorite foods, but I think too often we tend to eat the same kinds of foods. Again, variety is something I think that we all could benefit from, variety and moderation. The other thing that we hear from time to time is expense, how expensive our food is. Well, we use less of our income for food than any other nation in the world. 16 to 18% of our income is spent on food. A majority of the rest of the world spends anywhere from 70 to 95% of their income on food. So I think there's an economic side to food, and oftentimes the economic side of it governs what we eat. But I think that should not deter us from eating good kinds of foods. We also have a variety of foods, as I said, but also we have those with us year-round. We don't just have the fresh fruits and vegetables during the summer months. They're there all the time. So sometimes they're frozen, but oftentimes they're fresh. You can usually buy most fresh foods year-round if you're willing to pay the price, but they're at least available to us. The other thing is they appear very nice and neat, don't they? I can't remember it, but I think perhaps many of you can remember some of the foods that were in the marketplace had blemishes on them, but they were perfectly all right. Nutritionally, fine. But we've come to expect that tomato that doesn't have any blemishes at all, God forbid if they had, where do they go? They get thrown away. The other concern and misconception is that all of our food is so highly processed that there's nothing left, that it's bland and there are no nutrients in it. Well, that's true for some foods, but a minority of them. Most of our foods are very nutritious if we choose them carefully, if we learn to read the labels that are on the sides of foods. And again, choose a variety of them. Our processing, some of the bad comes with the processing in the sense that if we want to have it year-round, we'll have to expect that some of those nutrients might be lost if they're to be maintained on the shelf. Now, I'm not making a judgment about processed foods here. I have my own opinion on them. I can share them with you. But by and large, they're fairly nutritious. There are some cautions here, and we'll get to those a little bit later. Now, there are certain foods, I guess, that one could probably totally avoid, and you would not suffer. In fact, I think you'd benefit a great deal. One of these is sugar. In the early 1900s, those people probably ate no more than 3 to 4 pounds of sugar a year. Anyone venture a guess as to what that is now? Yes, over 100, nearly 105 pounds of sugar per person per year. Now that means that some of us are eating a lot more than the rest. That is a lot of sugar. And our dispositions aren't all that sweet as a result of it either. The other are high cholesterol foods. Now, some of these should be avoided by certain people for medical reasons, but by and large, unless you know that, take your time to check your cholesterol level, which I think one should do yearly. Again, in moderation, those foods are all right. Our body produces cholesterol. We really don't need any in our diet. So one could choose diets that have no cholesterol, but a little bit of it is not going to harm you. Salt. We hear a lot about salt these days. Basically, it's been in our food as a preservative. We've acquired a taste for it. Again, it's something that we don't need. There is enough salt naturally in most foods. If you eat a variety of foods, enough of the sodium and the chloride that's there that one doesn't need to use salt in foods. And again, I guess that's something that I think can be removed from the table, should be removed, and in many cases can be removed or at least lowered in some of the foods that we buy off the shelf. Those are just a few misconceptions. We'll get to some others later, and there are many other things in nutrition that people ask me questions about. If some of you have questions as we go along, please feel free to ask them. Okay?
A couple things that Jim mentioned give rise to some thoughts that I have about misconceptions. The first one he mentioned was about the expense of food and how really inexpensive, relatively, food is in this country. How many of you are farmers here or have been farmers at one time or another? What percentage would you estimate, or do you know, of the dollar you spend for food goes to the farmer? Anybody know that? Depends on the item a little bit, but the highest percentage is about 15%. The lowest, like for a piece of bread, is about 6%. So there's a real issue, not just of dollars and cents and nutrition, but an issue of politics at work here. Nutrition literally means life. And most of us know how difficult it is to make a living as farmers these days. The number of farms in the last 15 years halved in our country, which has social consequences as well. So when you begin to see these issues, they're very interconnected. And the issue of low expense for us, for paying for food, has worked its way down so that the farmer has very little, and the people in the middle with the processing and the packaging and all the merchandising have made more of the money. A very serious, I think, political question. On the issue of sugar, I think sometimes we think if we just have the right sugar, some brown sugar, that'll be better. Same sugar, just a little bit different color. Or perhaps if we have some honey, it's natural, it comes out of bees, that's better. Still sugar. Same stuff. We're not off the hook on that one. I went that whole route thinking if I just could get away from my sweet tooth to be satisfied. There are other kinds of sweets, and I think that maybe in the next section when we talk about the what's of eating, I think Jim will probably be referring to some of those positive kinds of sweets that we can be having in a more natural kind of way. But the ways we try to slide down that scale through honey just don't make it. One other one on the salt issue. I think we think if the salt is taken away, our food is going to be very bland and tasteless. Well, I think we've gotten accustomed to seasoning food with salt and that giving us the taste. Foods have remarkable tastes, and in the right combinations and creatively cooked, taste very, very good. There's a whole range of herbs and spices that don't have the negative effects, and in fact even may have therapeutic and positive effects. But it means that we have to be more creative in our cooking. And as I look around the group here, and the number of older people here, I expect many of you cook that way. But I know for my generation, the challenge is not to rely on one shaker to give the taste to a meal. There are many things that we can grow and that we can plant and that we can put on our food that'll give taste that won't have the negative effects of salt. One other area very quickly, that's the area of protein. You hear a lot of people saying, if I just get enough protein today, I'll make it through the day. Protein, what does protein do? Pardon? It builds muscle. Now, do you want to build your muscle during the day? Probably not. You probably want to have energy. Now, what is it that gives us energy? Sugar? A sort of energy, yeah. A rush of energy. Carbohydrates, right. In our next session, and maybe this would be a way to lead in to the session on the bread and butter, the what's of food, the food facts, Jim can share with us some of those very basic things that maybe we learned when we were very young. Maybe we've forgotten, but I think we need to be reminded sometimes of the very basic building blocks of food. Jim?
There's a saying in nutrition, I'm not sure where it came from, but it's you are what you eat. I guess maybe that's true for some of us. There are a lot of names that we tend to put on people. Some people tend to be a ham. There are others that we call corny. Some of us are a little nuts. There's the hot dog, people with a wry sense of humor. Those of us that eat bananas tend to be appealing.
Oh, no.
Well, I guess maybe that's not exactly what they were talking about, but we are what we eat in a sense, that if we eat positively, I think we're going to tend to be a more positive individual. When we think about this, there are, I guess, what we call the macronutrients, carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. Those are all necessary. We need those more or less on a daily basis in our diet. And then there are the vitamins and the minerals, which we call the micronutrients. First of all, Dave mentioned protein. There's a mystique about protein. The word itself means life. And that's kind of drifted down through the years. And even as a nutrition student, I can remember being somewhat intrigued about protein relative to fat or carbohydrate. Those seem to be rather unexciting. And as I thought about that, reflected on it, I can see why that's happened, because of the aura that surrounds the word protein. Protein basically builds up the tissues that we break down every day, and we need that. It serves other functions in the body as well, in terms of building our muscles, but basically it's a maintenance type of a nutrient for most individuals, and of course for the growing individual it's very important, and they need relatively more. The problem with our diet in terms of protein is that we tend to eat too much of it. Most of us only need about 45 to 55 grams, or about 1.5 or 2 ounces of protein a day. That would be equivalent to about 6 ounces of meat, 4 to 5 glasses of milk. You know, each of these would be equivalent to the total amount of protein you need, or 3 cups of beans. If one breaks down your diet, you probably find that for most of us, we're eating somewhere between 70 and 120 grams of protein a day. So we generally eat more than we need. The excess protein that our body doesn't use gets converted into fat. So protein can make you fat, just as fat will make you fat, or carbohydrates will make you fat. What about carbohydrates? I overheard someone earlier this week talking about the bread here and saying, oh, you know, if you're eating too much bread, I'll get fat from that. And they mentioned a few other things about it, and I didn't break into the conversation. I just let them go on. They were talking amongst themselves. But that's another misconception, I think, that certain kinds of carbohydrate foods tend to be fat. Well, any food is going to be fat if you eat too much of it, to be sure. But generally speaking, when we talk about carbohydrate foods, I think we can talk about those that we call complex and those that are somewhat refined, such as some of the sugars. Our diet contains far too little complex carbohydrates, most of us. And we can all benefit from eating more of the complex carbohydrates, the vegetables and the fruits. The fruits add sort of a sweetening taste to our foods, you know, the natural sweeteners. So, you know, if you're shoving aside that baked potato, don't do that, because that is a very good complex carbohydrate. It's not going to make you fat unless you eat a lot of it. On the other hand, you know, as we've already mentioned, the refined sugars contain really nothing else. They're refined, as the word suggests. There's nothing left in them but the carbohydrate. And then fat. Again, this is a nutrient that we all need, although very little of it. Only 1 or 2% of our diet really needs to be fat, certain kinds of fats. Well, our food would be very unpalatable if we had that level of fat intake. We probably could not eat that kind of food, and most of us don't. There are many different kinds of fats that you'll find on the market. The fats that occur in meats are basically what we call saturated fats, which is the technical name for describing the fact that we have a long chain of carbon atoms with little hydrogen molecules sticking on them, and the carbons have all the hydrogens they can contain. And those are basically the solid fats that we find oftentimes in meats for the most part, but not totally. There are some plant products that contain saturated fats too. Then there's the unsaturated fats that have been recommended in terms of our diet to prevent certain diseases such as coronary heart disease. Our diet did contain a lot of saturated fat up until about 10 years ago, and we've really kind of done a reversal. Most of the fat that we have in our diet now is of the unsaturated nature. Not all of it, but a little bit more than half of it. And I think that's been to our benefit. In fact, one of the things that we're seeing, it may not be a cause and effect, but at least it's an observation, that we're beginning to see coronary heart disease decrease. It's actually going down. Some of that, some people attribute to a change in diet, and not necessarily just totally eliminate cholesterol from our diet. Cholesterol is not a fat. But I think we all could benefit from eating more of the polyunsaturated fats in our diet. But one thing that I'd like to underline is that we eat way too much fat. our diets contain somewhere between 40 and 50% fat. So we've gone overboard. Too much fat, too little complex carbohydrate. And if we kind of reverse those, we'd be much better off. The protein, as I said, tends to be a little bit on the high side. We could reduce that, but I think that too would reverse itself a little bit if we were to switch from some of the to the more complex carbohydrates in our diet. And one good example of that, if you aren't already aware of it, is the food that they serve here at Holden. By and large, contains a large amount of complex carbohydrates. And that always used to be a thing when you go to camp, you get all these starchy foods. Well, you may think it's starchy here, but it's good for you. You know, and it's of such a variety. And I think you'll have to agree that the taste is very good. And it does provide a greater variety, I think, in kinds of foods than if you just have the old meat and potato routine all the time. That's fine once in a while. But certainly the foods that they've served here, in terms of, I think, the overall nutrition is very good. The protein part of it, what you've been getting are proteins that are what are called complemented proteins. The plant proteins are incomplete. They don't contain all of the necessary components for our body, certain ones. But if you put them together, by adding them together, then they become complete proteins. An example of a complete protein is meat or milk. Those are what we would call complete proteins. But the other things like soybeans, rice are incomplete. By complementing, serving them in the same meal, it's just as good a source as the meat or as the milk was. If one does this kind of thing, in choosing foods which contain adequate amounts of complex carbohydrates, reduce the amount of fat in your diet, and choose a variety of foods, and you know that maybe sound very trite, but a variety of foods, you're going to then obtain the other nutrients, the vitamins and minerals that one needs. And again, I emphasize variety. Don't get in a rut and choose, you know, the same foods. Serve peas all the time, or you know, simply eat that hamburger all the time. Those kinds of things can lead to some nutritional problems.
Shifting gears a little bit, I'd like to share some thoughts on more than just the what of eating, but the how, the where, the when, the with whom, and the why. Nutrition, as we said before, means life. And we know that life is more than just what you put into your mouth. There's a lot more variety to the issue of food and nutrition than just carbohydrates, fats, minerals, and the nuts and bolts of food, as it were. As I began to reflect on this part of nutrition, this dimension of nutrition, I began to think about where I was at in my own life. For example, how I eat. A good story might illustrate it. I used to live in Los Angeles. Most of you probably, many of you have been to Los Angeles, and you know what the lifestyle of Los Angeles is like. It's fast food restaurants on every other corner, freeways, people driving around, high mobility, and a lot of commotion and activity. Now, I thought that I was eating pretty well, and I had pretty good control of my life, until I found myself, in most cases, following the same pattern that most people around me in Los Angeles were following. I really didn't make a decision. I just found myself literally sort of swept onto the freeway, swept into the fast food places, and eating like the rest of the Southern Californians that I was living with. One night at dinner, I was living with a group of students in a student community we had. Usually we started our meal with devotions, and it was kind of a quiet time. And after 2 or 3 minutes of dinner, I noticed we were all just shoveling it in about as fast as we could. And I just commented to everybody in the group, we're eating awfully fast. Maybe we ought to slow down. So we all slowed down for 30 seconds. And 10 seconds later, we were just shoveling it back in again. And I was wondering, well, what in the world is going on here? Until I listened, the radio was going in the other music, in the other room. And the music on the radio was Scott Joplin playing some ragtime. And we were just eating right along with this music, just right up to the speed of the music. And for me, that's been a parable of what we do with our eating. Healthy kind of feeling. When we go through a cafeteria, how do we eat? Well, we kind of move along the line and somebody pushes us and we don't wait too long and we don't want to leave things on the table too long, so we tend to eat in a certain manner. The how of our eating, I think, oftentimes, unless we take time and enjoy and relax, tends to be sort of gulping and on the run. And I think we can find all sorts of problems that happen nutritionally from that way of eating. When do we eat? I mentioned before that 8 o'clock or 6 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and 6 o'clock in the evening style fits a highly active and urban or rural kind of lifestyle. I think we can look at other possibilities within an urban setting, like I was suggesting, perhaps with smaller meals spaced out at shorter intervals. So the issue of when you eat is a question as well. How many of you usually eat at 12 o'clock? When you look up, that's the time to eat. Or at 6 o'clock in the evening, you look up at the clock, you find yourself sort of looking up there and saying, well, now it's time to eat. Are you always hungry at 6 o'clock at night? You are, right? Okay. Most of us are probably hungry at a certain time of the evening, but how much of that is real hunger and how much of it is the habit of looking up at the clock and saying it's time to eat? It's hard to tell sometimes where the line is divided. I hear people saying the difference between mouth hunger and stomach hunger. Sort of like you look through magazines and you see a tort, or you see some beautiful watermelon there. You know, whether you're hungry or you've eaten 5 minutes ago, you usually become hungry. And I think that same kind of habit happens when we are looking through the media or when we look at the clock. We should really ask ourselves, why do we eat? When do we eat? We should look at the how of our eating as well. In Los Angeles, I found myself one day cleaning out my car after being there for about 2 months. I had moved from the Midwest. And I looked in the back seat, and I could hardly get the door open because there were so many wrappers back there from Jack in the Box and McDonald's. I mean, it was piled almost all the way up to the seat. I think if you were to look in most cars in Southern California, you'd find that same phenomenon of wrappers all the way up to the back seat. You just kind of eat it and you throw it in the back, and you can't litter the highway, so you litter the back of your car. Eating in your automobile, there are coffee stains on this one old VW I had on the, you know, the little thing they have in there. I don't imagine they had this in the early vehicles, but you let the glove box down, there's these two little things there. And you put your coffee, it never works. It always spills on the floor. But you drink your coffee as you're going down the freeway. In Los Angeles, it's comic, it's tragic and it's comical at the same time as you, 6 o'clock in the morning, drive through the fog to work. You look over and here's somebody eating a Winchell's donut right next to you, trying to drink their coffee and trying to read the paper at the same time as they drive into work. The stress levels are absolutely enormous as people try to juggle all of those things, forgetting the fact that nutrition and food is life. I think we could look at that and challenge it in all of our lives to some degree. With whom do you eat? Eating is a community activity. It's an activity which we'll talk about a little bit later as a reason for celebration. It's a place in which care takes place. Again, my model is Southern California. Living in Southern California, I found that the thing that was lacking perhaps most with the students I worked with in the university was any sense of community, any sense of real family. Mom worked, Dad worked, and usually what the recipe for dinner was a note on the refrigerator door saying it's on the third shelf. And that's very often the way meals became. And I began to challenge that in my own life, and when we created our student community, if we had a religious event each day, it was sitting down to a meal, sitting down and breaking bread, sitting down and taking time to share food with somebody else. I'm sure some of you live alone or have lived alone at certain times in your life. Eating alone can be a good experience. It can be a meditative experience. But by and large, I think most of us, if we had a choice, would rather eat with people and share food and have it an opportunity to share more than just the nutritional food aspects, also the life-giving aspects of conversation and companionship. Why do we eat? What are some of the reasons you eat? Well, you're hungry. That's an obvious one. What are some of the other reasons you eat? Habit, right, like at 6 o'clock, at 12 o'clock, and at 6 o'clock again. And then usually around 10 o'clock at night, there's that late night snack, right? Popcorn, a little bit of milk. It'd be interesting to see what the various habits you have about 10 o'clock are. What are some other reasons why we eat? Depression and boredom. Yeah, things start going badly, I head for the refrigerator, you know, as if that's going to make me feel better. Usually it makes me feel worse because then I'm bloated as well as depressed. But we very often eat because we're feeling depressed or maybe bored. What are some other reasons?
Self-reward.
Pardon?
Self-reward.
Self-reward. What would be an example for you of that? Right. Mowing the lawn, cleaning the house, you've earned, what do you earn? A three beers, a piece of cake, you know, that piece of pie you've been holding there for a couple of days. I know for me, when I run a marathon, I abstain in training for it. Then I go eat it, like a half gallon of ice cream. I just pig out, as I say. Just eat as much as I can. Yeah, reward. We do that oftentimes. Not because we're hungry necessarily, but just to kind of pay ourselves off. Now, that's not necessarily bad. I think food is a kind of reward. But if it's the wrong kinds of food and in the wrong amounts, I think it can be real negative. What are some other reasons why we eat, do you suppose? Anything else? Yeah. The taste, a very positive kind of thing, right. Yeah, there's some very tantalizing kinds of tastes that you really want to savor and enjoy, sure. Pardon me? Sure, sociability, the companionship, being together with other people, enjoying conversation. Yeah, that really makes eating enjoyable.
You're worried,
yeah. What do you eat when you get worried? What's your favorite thing that makes you less worried, or at least you think will make you less worried? Anything in particular? Whatever's handy? Right, right. Scotch on the rocks. Right. A lot of grain there, right? Right. Okay, I think we see the point that there are a lot more aspects to nutrition, either life-giving or life-taking away or life-denying aspects when we talk about food and nutrition. Now, alongside of that, we might call this a new vision. It's not a new vision at all. It's maybe rediscovering some old lessons. I don't know how many new lessons we need to learn. We probably need to relearn old lessons. An interesting area that Jim has been working in is the area of cure or of health in relationship to diet, particularly in the area of cancer and longevity. Maybe he'd like to share some things about that.
Okay, before I get into that in detail, I guess I'd just like to pick up on what Dave was talking about here, that all those things that were mentioned can have some direct impact in terms of your nutrition, how one utilizes those foods. The rapidity with which one eats can affect your health. The assimilation of that food can differ depending on your mental condition. So, you know, those things can go hand in hand. Not only the food you're choosing when you're doing this, but also what happens to that food once you ingest it into your body. For instance, someone mentioned alcohol, and while we don't consider alcohol a food, unfortunately it is replacing a lot of the calories, of good calories, I guess, in our diet. There are some people that can consume up to anywhere from 1/4 to 1/3 of their daily calories is alcohol. Alcohol contains a lot of calories. One can become nutritionally deficient for a number of reasons, but also you can become very fat consuming alcohol. So it'll get you from both ends. Well, not the hard alcohols, no. But in the beers, there are carbohydrates. One of the areas that recently has, come of age, is the application of nutrition to certain diseases. Now, interestingly, most of the knowledge about nutrition came from deficiencies originally, deficiency conditions. And then we learned what nutrients were needed because we recognized certain specific deficiencies. For instance, pellagra in the South was very common in the early 1900s, and that's one of the things that led to the discovery of the vitamin niacin. Scurvy, if you're all familiar with that in terms of vitamin C. Beriberi, in terms of thiamine. But once we had identified what we feel are the necessary nutrients, and there may still be some to be identified yet, and that's not a closed book, the next challenge really came in, what's the net effect of combining certain kinds of foods on our health, because foods contain not only nutrients but many other components also, and the necessary balance of those. One of the areas that I've been working is in the area of nutrition and cancer, trying to sort out whether or not the foods that we eat can either benefit us in terms of reducing the risk for cancer, or whether certain foods can lead to certain types of cancer. This area of research has been, again, going on for a number of years, but really within the last 10 years, what I call it, very active, where they've begun to look at specific populations who have a very low incidence of certain types of cancers. One of the interesting groups are the Seventh-day Adventists, a religious group, and they have some dietary practices which are not necessarily a prescription of the church, but strongly suggested by the church. And basically, it's a vegetarian type of diet. Well, there are a number of populations in the United States within certain locales. One of them happens to be in California. Another happens to be up in the Portland area of Oregon. And when they've studied these populations, they found that they have a lower incidence, lower mortality, also of certain types of cancers. Among these would be colon cancer, breast cancer, and a number of other types of cancers. Not all types, but many which seem to be related basically to the foods they're eating. Now, they also, one also has to be careful here, because they also have some other practices which are separate from what I would call straight nutrition. They avoid alcohol, and most of them do not drink beverages that contain caffeine. And by and large, most of them do not smoke. Now, these could be complicating factors, but once they've accounted for these factors and done this scientifically, there still is remaining there the factor of diet. And basically, as I said, they eat a vegetarian type diet. There are also other observations from other countries who have different types of diets and different incidences of cancer. One of these is the Japanese. They have a very low rate of colon cancer. Japanese. And they've studied the Japanese as they've moved to the United States and looked at the first, second, and third generation. And in each case, the incidence of colon cancer goes up in each of these generations. The primary thing that's changed is their diet as they've looked at them and studied them. Well, the other thing that's happening in Japan, unfortunately, is that they're becoming somewhat westernized in terms of their diet. They've introduced the fast food shops. They've introduced the foods that contain a higher level of fat. And what's happening then is we're seeing that the incidence of these cancers are also going up in the Japanese. And there are other observations that one could give of other populations. Well, what we've done in my laboratory is to ask the next question of, okay, there's this observation. That doesn't show cause and effect. You can't show cause and effect just by that kind of observation that these people eat a different type of diet than most of us in America and explain the cancer incidence on that basis alone. One really has to try and sort this out and say, okay, what is really happening then to the body with these different types of diets? Is there something that would suggest that that has changed biochemically in the body because of the foods they're eating? One of the things that we found that the level of, and we were looking at breast cancer, specifically in terms of nutrition, and we're looking at populations that have different types of diets and looking at the level of hormones in the body, because some of the hormones may lead to breast cancer, at least if they have too high a level. And that was the theory that we were working on. And we found that when we looked at the Seventh-day Adventist population and the non-vegetarians, that there was a difference. There was a difference in the level of the hormones in the body, which does fit with the fact that the Seventh-day Adventists have less breast cancer. I think we're beginning to see that by the kinds of foods you eat and the mix of foods that you eat, one can, I guess maybe put cure in parentheses here, but essentially begin to prevent or at least lower the risk of certain types of diseases. We've seen this with coronary heart disease and cholesterol, and I think fats in our diet. I think that is beginning to have an effect. We have reduced the amount of cholesterol in our diet. I think that is beginning to have a beneficial effect. And that's done not only before you have the disease, but also why you have the disease. And that's certainly true of heart disease. And I think, by and large, we'll see that that's also going to be true of the disease we call cancer. The other thing is just in terms of the therapy, it gets into the care and the cure part of it. They're finding that the cancer patient, once they do have the cancer, if they're given some nutritional support before they go into surgery, before they're given chemotherapy or radiation therapy, they will do better. They will tolerate the surgery, the chemotherapy, much better. They come out of the surgery feeling better, and they do better afterwards. They can tolerate a higher dose of the drug that they're given. That then gives them, I think, an added benefit in terms of possible remission or cure of that disease. So nutritional support and therapy is true not only in terms of prevention, but I think also in terms of the care of the patient, no matter what the disease is. And I think you'll find in most hospitals these days that if it's a good hospital that has an excellent dietetic staff, trained dietitians who know their nutrition and can relate that to the nurse, to the doctor, to the pharmacist, all of them then working in concert, trying to treat whatever disease that might be. I guess I'd put the fresh and the frozen on the same plane, by and large. And there, of course, there'd be slight differences there. The canned, you're going to lose some nutrients as a result of that. But certainly, I think the fresh, if you have access to them, would be preferable. The information that we have on freeze drying, you know, for those of you going hiking off in the woods, you lose a lot of nutrients when you freeze dry food. Fortunately, now they're developing new techniques so they can freeze dry very quickly. And that's helping to retain some of those nutrients. But if you have your own freeze, drying apparatus at home, it's not freeze drying, but it, I think, speaks to the same point. You lose a lot of the nutrients. It's all right in minimal amounts, but I would not rely on it solely as a source of nutrients, because you do lose a lot of it. You still retain the carbohydrate, the fat, the protein. Those aren't lost by and large. But usually the vitamins are the things that you lose. The minerals are retained, of course, unless it's washed out. I live in an area that is essentially selenium deficient, and that's a problem. What probably saves most of those people, and myself included, is that our food is shipped in from all over the United States, from areas that have adequate selenium in the soil. But if you're growing your own food locally, one needs to be concerned about that. As yet, we've not identified specific deficiencies of selenium in individuals. And we've looked at this problem at where I'm at to see if this does exist. You find that the levels that are in the body are a little bit lower, but not low enough to cause concern as yet. Well, there is that relationship between selenium and cancer, at least in animals, and some people are translating that to humans, suggesting that there may be a link there. As yet, there haven't been adequate studies in enough places to really see if there's a real strong association, or if the levels in the blood, which is what we look at, are different in the cancer patient than in the non-cancer patient, before we could really say anything.
I'm sure there's going to be a lot of questions, and I know we're getting really close to time. Maybe I just say a couple of words about this, and as you have questions, you can speak with Jim or myself after we've broken up. I think when we get into this area of a new vision of cure, care, change, and celebration, what we're talking about is nutrition as lifestyle. That what gives life to you, your food, the way you eat your food, when you eat your food, with whom you eat your food. Perhaps the most basic non-food need we have as human beings beyond shelter is care or love. And again, as we've said before, that most often takes place in most families around the table. It takes place most times in the breaking of bread. I don't think it's curious or surprising, therefore, that when you look into the gospel accounts of the life of Jesus, that most of those situations in which people gathered and bread was broken, special kinds of things happened. Special life was given. Special kinds of blessings occurred. On the road to Emmaus, when the disciples were walking and this stranger, this man, walks up and starts speaking with him. There's not a recognition that takes place of Christ to these men until the breaking of bread. In the same kind of way, Jesus, when he's speaking with the woman of Samaria at the well, she's asking for water. She's asking for a very basic nutritional need. But he also suggests beyond the water that there's a kind of water, a kind of life that he has that comes, which he is offering her that doesn't wear out or that doesn't end. It's a close correlation between care and love and nutrition. And I think we need to remind ourselves it's not a new vision at all. It's a rediscovery of an old vision. And that we need to spend time together in a caring kind of way around the table. That goes hand in hand, obviously, with celebration. What I call this is Eucharistic eating. The Eucharist, one of the reasons I think we have come to rename or to recover the old name for the Lord's Supper, or for communion as it came to be called, was for many of us Lutherans, the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper was kind of a sad kind of affair or a somber kind of affair. But Eucharist means thanksgiving. Eucharist means really celebration. And truly the Lord's Supper is a time for celebration. It's a time for gathering and celebrating the life-giving quality of both bread and wine and Christ's presence in the meal. When I think of Eucharistic eating in our normal meals, I think of the cartoon, probably some of you have it in your Sunday paper, is it called the Family Circle? Family Circus. Alongside of that, there's another one where this couple, he always has all the girly pictures up in his shop downstairs, and they eat at Burt's Beanery. You know which cartoon that is? This couple, I can't recall their names, but I remember the story because when they go out to dinner, he never wants to take her to a fancy restaurant. It's always to Burt's Beanery. And they go down to Burt's Beanery, and that's all they ever have at Burt's Beanery, but Burt always fixes beans 30 different ways. You never know how he's going to have beans. And that suggests to me that even though we may eat the same kinds of things, there's great varieties in the way we can prepare our food, even beans. He was saying that 3 cups of beans are your need for protein in one day. There are numerous cookbooks over in the bookstore here that talk about very appetizing and creative ways of fixing very simple kinds of meals, accentuating not just the taste, but the sight and the sounds and the flavors and all of the senses as one eats. Burt's Beanery was a very boring place because it was always, he always had the variety, but it was always beans. I think we can prepare, because we have the variety in American culture and American supermarkets, to prepare a wide variety of food in a wide variety of ways and bring in that aspect of Eucharistic eating. And I think not only discover each other once again in food, but I think we can also discover the religious dimension there as well. We could talk about change, which is the political dimension, maybe perhaps at another time. But I think you can see that there are some very interrelated aspects, that nutrition is far more than just what we eat. It's when, where, why, with whom, and when, and 3 aspects or 4 aspects of cure, care, celebration, and change. How is the time? I have about 5 minutes by my watch. Maybe it's closer on yours. Are there just a couple of questions that some folks would like to ask Jim or myself about what we've been sharing?
One of the concerns he's asking about a high amount of unsaturated fat. One of the things that can happen when you consume unsaturated fats or use it in food preparation is that can be changed if you heat it too much. And it then can be changed to some potentially toxic compounds. I think that's where the danger lies. I think it'd be very difficult to eat too much unsaturated fat unless you're eating a lot of oils. But if one is careful in the amount of heat that you use in preparing foods, that's important too, that you don't overcook them or use too much of that and consume that. Basically, it has to do with the way the fat breaks down as it's heated.